morning. Welcome to Radioactivity. I'm Rob Loray. Coming up today, we're going to talk with an author who's written a new book describing how he believes Russia began grooming Donald Trump 40 years ago by saving him from financial ruin. We're going to talk with the author of American Compromat in just a moment. First, three or four listener comments that came in after Monday's program. And a couple of the comments were about the exchange that we played between U.S. Senator Rand Paul and George Stephanopoulos on ABC News on Sunday, where Rand Paul continued to deny that there was a fair election on November 3rd. Here's what several listeners had to say.
This is the elusive traveling nurse. I always text you. But I have to call in and say this. I will start with, I am not a sports fan. I could care less about sports. They just don't do it for me. But I understand a lot of people are psyched about the books. Okay, that's all good. But what I don't like is what I just saw on TV, where they're giving this big press conference downtown, and they're talking about, come on to Florida. We got great weather, and we're really safe with COVID. I have a real problem with that. Nobody should be traveling right now. We're in the middle of a bloody pandemic. The entire country should not be traveling. I just don't understand that mentality. It's all about money. Money doesn't mean anything when you're dead. Line your coffin with it and see how well it works for you then.
I'm calling to weigh in. I'm in Douglas. I live in St. Petersburg, Florida. I'm 64 years old. I'm a graduate of the prestigious Eckerd College, and I'm an American Studies major. That being said, I learned so much about immigration, and I wonder why in the last 20 years our senators and congressmen have not fixed this thing. 20 years, the problem is way too long. 10 would have been reasonable. Not really. 5 would have been great. If anybody thinks they're working for a living, they should have figured this out. 8-year plan, I can see how that would work with Biden, but I don't know why there wasn't a plan beforehand. The fact that Florida's agriculture would collapse is news to me without migrant workers. We should think about that as Americans. And it reminds me of in California when the head of the Migrant Workers Association said, bring it. If you want to work, just bring it.
Yeah, the comments by Rand Paul during that interview with George Stephanopoulos, it's very clear that the conservatives and the Republicans are very frustrated by the fact that the media has stopped giving airtime to people who are spouting nonsense, and that they are now challenging it instead of simply being standing silent while someone's, you know, claims that there is no such thing as man-made climate change, or that the election was stolen, or any number of other planks that they hold to, you know, because that's a tactic they've used for a long time, and it's a great thing that the major news outlets are refusing to simply let anyone on spout any nonsense they want in the name of balance. So I'm sure the Republicans are really dismayed that they're no longer able to exploit that.
This is Ron in Tampa, and I just wanted to say Monday's 11 o'clock show, you played an interview between George Stephanopoulos and Rand Paul, and I was shocked, even though I've elevated my shock level. Rand Paul was rambling, incoherent, and simply unreasonable, which goes to show how far out of touch he and so many others who were in Trump's camp now are. He didn't make an argument except for the fact that he is not dealing in the reality that Trump lost the election fair and square.
Some listener comments that came after Monday's program. We didn't play the comments over the last 2 days because we were fundraising and trying to raise $73,000 to keep MNF going for a few more months. We're going to not fundraise until the second week in March again. And yesterday we came up short of that $73,000 goal. Thanks to everybody that supported WMNF, the music pro shows, and the public affairs programs. But we did come up about $5,000 short. So it would really help us out. If you missed the fund drive yesterday, we hope that you'll make a contribution right now. You can do it easily by going to the app on your phone, and there's a tip jar if you're listening on your phone, or you can go to WMNF.org on the web and make a contribution there and help us make up that $5,000 shortfall. Well, coming up today, we're going to talk about Donald Trump. He was allegedly cultivated as a Russian asset more than 40 years ago, and the details are explained in a brand new book by Craig Unger. Craig makes the revelations in his new book, American Kompromat, how the KGB cultivated Donald Trump and related tales of sex, greed, power, and treachery. The book has just come out. Unger's been on this program before. He did the famous book, House of Bush, House of Saud, and the describing the strong connection between the Saudi Arabian government and the Bush family. This latest book, Unger says, that Trump and the Russians were in bed together through Trump's close friendship with Jeffrey Epstein, the financier who committed suicide allegedly a year ago. He was supplying the Russians in Silicon Valley with underage girls, the author claims. And so we're going to talk today with Craig Unger about his explosive new book, American Kompromat. Craig Unger, welcome to WMNF. Welcome back, I should say. Congratulations on the new book. I think I want to start with this question of, was Donald Trump a Russian asset? And you come to a pretty firm conclusion.
Absolutely. Yes, he was a Russian asset. And, you know, that's really not such a new revelation. The top intelligence people in America, John Brennan, James Clapper, Dan Coats, these were the top pre-Trump intelligence officials, and they've all said he's a Russian asset. But no one has really gone back and tried to say what that really means, how did it begin, and what is the sequence of events through which it happened. And what I try to go back to is go back more than 40 years, and I see step by step, this is how it happened, how they reached out to him, how they cultivated him, how they brought him to Moscow for the first time, and how they played him. And that means he really is an asset that started back in the Soviet Union. When the Soviet Union collapsed, it continued with the Russian Federation, and he is deeply indebted to Russia, and that they own him.
When did the Soviets and then the Russians, when did the Soviets take notice of Donald Trump as a possible useful person to know, and what made them think he was useful?
Well, first, you know, a lot of people think, oh, you know, I grew up, I'm old enough that I remember the Manchurian Candidate and these elaborate conspiracies and the horrifying notion that they could put an asset or agent in the White House. It didn't happen the same way in real life, but it did happen. And it started as a series of overlapping events. One of the very first happened in 1980. That's more than 40 years ago. And Donald Trump had just started, had just completed his first really, really successful real estate development. It's the Grand Hyatt Hotel right next to Grand Central Station. And like any hotel, it needed television sets in all its rooms. So where did they go shopping for TV sets? Well, what was very unusual, and some of this purchase has been reported before, but Trump went to a small, he went to an electronics shop owned by Soviet emigres on Lower Fifth Avenue near the Flatiron Building in New York. And what I found out, that purchase had been reported before by Bloomberg, but what I add to the picture is that it was really a fund for the KGB, and the owner had ties to the KGB. He was known as a spotter agent. A spotter agent is someone who recruits asset for the KGB. And when he goes to Trump and he says, well, you can have all these TV sets, presumably at a very low price. And in doing so, the KGB, in effect, was opening its doors to Donald Trump for the first time. And that's one way in which cultivation of Donald Trump as a Russian asset began to take place.
What were some of the other meetings along the way that increased the Russians' interest in Donald Trump?
Well, another thing that I learned for the first time is there was a woman named Natalia Dubinina. She had written her account of how she met Donald Trump in the 80s. Her father was the Soviet ambassador to the United Nations first, and later Soviet ambassador to the United States. She told a story which I've since, I think, have proven is full of lies about how her father cultivated Donald Trump. And I believe it's full of lies. I know it's full of lies because her father never spoke English. He was the only Russian ambassador, Soviet ambassador, rather, to the United States who never spoke English. That was been widely reported. And instead, it was Natalia herself, and she herself had ties to the KGB. She worked in the United Nations library, and it's those posts in the UN library, that is the Soviet officials who work there, were KGB agents. And I know that because I've now interviewed former KGB officials who are clearly who are telling me the whole story of how Trump was recruited.
So this woman, who's the daughter of a Soviet official, she puts out a cover story. She was the real agent. Her dad was not.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And what we see then is she was trying to cover what is known as the origin story of how Trump got in touch with Russian officials. And once you realize that the first reach outs were by KGB agents, you know that Trump is in their system. He's in their files one way or another as not as as someone who is working with them. And they cultivate him and they bring him to Russia. And it's during that point that I think the most amazing event of all took place. When I talked, one of my major sources was a man named Yuri Schwitz, who was a major in the KGB. And Yuri was in the KGB at this time. So it was his colleagues. He was in Washington Station, and it was his colleagues in New York who were recruiting Trump. And what you see is Trump being pushed, pumped full of KGB talking points. Trump was personally in New York known at the time as being sort of a playboy. In 1987, he started hanging out with Jeffrey Epstein. They had parties where there were two guys, Epstein and Trump, and 28 girls. You can just imagine what goes on at those parties. But Trump simultaneously was promoting himself as a great foreign policy expert, which was ludicrous, as a great expert in nuclear arms limitation and so forth. And I believe that the KGB was pumping him full of this information. When I talked to Yuri about it, he kind of laughed and said that Trump was the ideal recruit. He was vain. He was narcissistic. And what you do with someone like that is you flatter them. You say, oh, my God, you have such wonderful, unorthodox ideas about foreign policy. You should be president of the United States. And sure enough, Trump makes an abortive run for president, and he takes out a full-page ad in the New York Times, the Washington Post, and the Boston Globe, and it's got these wacky foreign policy ideas that we're being taken to the cleaners by NATO, that we should abandon our alliance with Japan. This is exactly what the KGB wanted. And when you look at that ad, it looked like nothing more than propaganda. And as Yuri told me, Yuri went back to KGB headquarters in the Soviet Union at the time. And in September of 1987, he got a memo, an internal memo that was being distributed by the Active Measures Division of the KGB. And they were celebrating the acquisition of a new asset for the KGB. And they included this ad that Donald Trump had taken out in the New York Times and the Post, and it was signed by Donald Trump. And that was the first time Yuri had heard the name Donald Trump, and it was in a memo in which they were the KGB was celebrating him as a new asset for the KGB.
And this was, of course, an ad that had all these KGB and Soviet talking points. We're talking with Craig Unger, who is the author of a brand new book, American Kompromat, how the KGB cultivated Donald Trump, and this is WMNF 88.5 FM. Craig, you also write in your book that Trump was rescued multiple times from multiple bankruptcies by boatloads of Russian cash. Give us some examples. The story's been told a bit previously, but what did you find out? How did the Russians rescue his real estate empire?
Right. This happened a lot, and I wrote about some of it in House of Trump, House of Putin, where we see him doing business with a lot of Russian mobsters. I found 13 of them who either lived or owned property in Trump Tower or other Trump properties. And what you saw going on there was really massive money laundering. In one case, a Russian Soviet emigre put down $5 million in cash. And that would be about $15 million today. And he just said, I'll take five condos. Well, normally you might say, what's going on here? Of course, Trump just takes the money and run and doesn't ask any questions. So that is, in effect, is money laundering. And Trump had 1,300 properties that were sold under similar circumstances. So we don't know how many of those were Russian or Soviet, but that's a lot of money. That's at the very least hundreds of millions of dollars and perhaps a couple of billion. In addition, as we go on in time, we see in 2002, and this is after Trump has gone belly up in Atlantic City, New Jersey, where he overexpanded egregiously and went bankrupt and had filed for six bankruptcies. But afterwards, who comes to his aid but former Soviet emigres and Russians through a real estate firm known as Bayrock. It is located in Trump Tower, and they make deals with Trump where they franchise his name. He puts up zero money. They develop the buildings. They put his name on it, and he gets very lucrative commissions out of it. And that saves him from bankruptcy. That bails him out yet again. So this is going on and on and on. And I suspect it's going on even today. In many ways, if you look at his businesses, he's a horrible businessman. He never honors his promises, and he goes belly up again and again. But there's a lot on the side we don't know. That's why he wants his tax records still secret.
Mm. Craig, wasn't the Mueller investigation designed to, at least in part, look into possible Russian connections to Donald Trump? And did the Mueller report find anything, or did it not? Talk about how the Mueller report fits into this.
Right. Well, that's a very good characterization, because we should have had a counterintelligence investigation. That's what's really important here. And that's the way it started out in the FBI when James Comey was there, and he was fired for it, as you recall. And when Mueller came in as special counsel, once again, it was supposed to be a counterintelligence operation. And I should point out that a counterintelligence investigation is very, very different than a criminal investigation. This is not a minor thing. A criminal investigation seeks to prosecute people. A counterintelligence investigation tries to get in at the bottom of intelligence operations and see what really happened. And the distinction is important because a lot of intelligence operations are designed to operate within the law. They're not, parts of them are not technically illegal. Yet when Mueller took over, the counterintelligence investigation was just dropped. And I think most of America didn't seem to notice that. The Washington Post had a couple of good stories on it. But other than that, very few people noticed what was really happening. So all of that was being suppressed. And that's where I come in, is I tried to get to the bottom of it as much as possible. Obviously, I don't have the resources Mueller has, subpoena power and a team of dozens of lawyers. But I think an awful lot of this is on the record. And you can see things happening. For example, what I'm about to describe, I think, is perfectly legal. Donald Trump Jr. went to Paris in October of 2016. That's just a month before the 2016 elections. In Paris, Trump Jr. gives a speech before a French think tank, and he's paid roughly $50,000 or more. Well, all of that's perfectly legal. What I haven't told you yet is that the think tank was really a front for Russian intelligence. And during that time, Trump Jr. was pumped full of talking points about what the Russians wanted America to do in the Middle East. And those talking points were delivered to Donald Trump. And worse, in 2017, just a year later, he implements them. He takes American troops out of Syria. He abandons our Kurdish allies, and he leaves the whole area for Russian domination. So this kind of thing was happening again and again and again. It's not technically illegal. It should be revealed in a counterintelligence investigation, but that has not happened yet.
And do we know why Mueller dropped it, or is it possible that he did a counterintelligence investigation but then kept it secret?
Well, that is possible that he kept it secret, but if it's secret, I don't know about that. It's worth looking at both William Barr and Robert Mueller, who were close friends. And William Barr was known as Mr. Whitewash, as the cleanup man. He had been attorney general before, during the administration of George H.W. Bush in the early 90s. And during that time, he effectively whitewashed major investigations, into the Iran-Contra scandal, into the Iraqgate scandal, and he granted pardons to all the people who were involved in that. And Barr himself, is a fascinating figure. I should add, when the book was finished, he was still in power. But Barr believes in the imperial presidency. He has the broadest interpretation possible of presidential powers. And he was good friends with Robert Mueller. Robert Mueller attended the weddings of Barr's two daughters. Barr has been very, very secretive, but I think his investigation was a spectacular disappointment. I think in a way the media pumped him up as a white knight who would gallop in on his steed and save America from this corrupt president. But that's not who he is. That's not who Mueller is. And that's not what happened.
Mm. Our guest is Craig Unger, and his brand new book is American Compromat, How the KGB Cultivated Donald Trump. Compromat is another word for blackmail, right?
Yes. I mean, it really means compromising material, but it's blackmail or extortion.
All right. So, you write that Trump and the Russians were also in bed together through Trump's close friendship with Jeffrey Epstein, who supplied the Russians in Silicon Valley with underage girls. Let's talk about how Epstein fits into your book.
Right. Well, again, it's about compromise, and a lot of people have done very wonderful reporting on the Epstein operation as a sex trafficking operation, and it absolutely was. But it's also, I see it as a compromise operation, as a blackmail operation in effect, and that it was all about documenting the dirty little secrets of the richest and most powerful people in the world. So we know that most of Epstein's residences, in which he had these big sex parties, had video cameras everywhere. And one thing I want to do is track where is all that compromise. That's compromise. That's a treasure trove of compromise. And there are an awful lot of people who may have their hands on it. Epstein may have had his hands on it. Of course, he died. Whether he was murdered or committed suicide is still unresolved, as far as I'm concerned. His partner, Ghislaine Maxwell, may have had it. She may still have it, even though she's in custody now. The legal authorities clearly have it or have had it, and that includes the Palm Beach Sheriff Department. And the Palm Beach Sheriff Department had it. One of their investigators gave it for safekeeping to a deputy sheriff who was sort of had left the department. And his name is John Mark Dugan, and he has since fled the country, and I tracked him down by phone in Moscow. And what's fascinating is once he arrived there and he told me he had access, he had 478 videotapes. And just a few days after arriving there, this fairly lowly former official in the Palm Beach County Sheriff's offices ends up meeting privately with one of the most powerful people in Russia, a man named Pavel Borodin. I have a photo of them together. It's in my book. And you see, you know, I asked my source, Yuri Spitz, what was going on. He just laughed and said, well, there's only one possible interpretation, and that is that John Mark Dugan is in the process of trying to sell kompromat to Russian intelligence.
Mm. You say Jeffrey Epstein made videotapes of sex acts that he could use for blackmail or kompromat, and he had photos of Trump with young girls, maybe underage girls, and a stain on Trump's pants. Tell us what's that about.
Right. Well, this was an associate of Jeffrey Epstein who told me this, and it was that Epstein had shown him, my source, a photo like that. That was Trump was with two women who were not fully clothed. They were very young. We don't know the exact age. And there was a stain, a wet stain on his trousers in a rather unfortunate position.
And Epstein had this photo.
Yes,
allegedly
throwing it around. Yes, and what's important about that is that at the time Epstein had and Trump had broken up. They had a friendship of about 15 years, but it broke open when they were vying for the same property, and Epstein was really really angry at Trump for buying a property out from underneath Epstein. And then going on to sell it to a very, very wealthy Russian oligarch at an insane profit.
This is a piece of property in Palm Beach, right here in Florida.
Absolutely.
Our guest is Craig Unger, and the book is American Kompromat, How the KGB Cultivated Donald Trump. And you're listening to WMNF in Tampa. Craig, I know we're down to the last few minutes, but one of the issues that comes up in your book that you're very suspicious about is Opus Dei, which is the far-right Catholic group. And you think, I mean, you know, I got to say, it sounds like a bit of a conspiracy theory, but you think that there's a secret organization that's really trying to exercise power at the highest levels here in the U.S., and that is Opus Dei. Why do you think that?
Well, if you look at it, and there have been a real movement it's a small movement in the Catholic right that has been very ascendant and very powerful, and it ties in with the Federalist Society, which is a very conservative legal society. And they promoted a lot of lawyers to the federal judiciary. And the Opus Dei is a sect. It's a prelature within the Catholic Church. It has roots in Spanish fascism going back to Franco. And its tenets its theology runs parallel to the ideology of deeply conservative people who have authoritarian views, who promote the notion of the imperial presidency. And what you've seen there is through the Federalist Society and so forth, people like William Barr come into power. He denies that he's in Opus Dei, but he was head of the Catholic Information Center, which is the operational headquarters of Opus Dei in Washington. The Opus Dei is a secret society, so it's hard to get into who is really legitimately a member or not. What we've seen is Trump appoint three deeply conservative Supreme Court justices who have links to the Federalist Society and possibly to Opus Dei, and they become enormously powerful. And under Trump, they've appointed hundreds of federal judges who have lifetime appointments, as well as three people to the United States Supreme Court.
Just getting back to Jeffrey Epstein, he claimed at one point, it's in your book, that he introduced Donald Trump to his third wife, to the former first lady.
Right. I mean, it's a very interesting thing to say, and I've not been able to verify it or refute it. But it's also worth looking at in a larger context, that Trump's three wives were all models. Two of them were Eastern European. And when you look at Epstein operation, you see a link to all these Russians and former Soviet people from the former Soviet Union, including procurers. I mean, one guy calls himself a matchmaker, but he provides women. He was once a modeling agent, and he ended up providing groups of women. Actually, they were girls. They were underage to the oligarchs, so that when you have your next yacht party, if you need 10 or 20 young girls, you call up this fellow named Petya Listerman, or you, if you're having a ski party in Davos or Stad, you may need 20 girls, and Petya Listerman would be the guy to call. And there are overlapping links between him and other procurers who were part of the whole Epstein enterprise.
Mm. And Donald Trump himself ran a modeling agency, and that comes up in your book as a possible questionable operation, whether it was a legitimate modeling agency or something more.
Well, absolutely. And I found some court documents in which an accountant, a woman who was part of a so-called modeling firm called MC2, which furnished women to Jeffrey Epstein, she describes how they put together their operation. And she says that the owner of her agency said, well, as a model, as a corporate model, rather, they should copy Trump's modeling management as a way of figuring out how to reimburse people, because it did sort of things that were sort of similar.
Now, Ghislaine Maxwell, who was the procuress for Jeffrey Epstein, she's in jail right now. She's awaiting legal action against her, accused of crimes. Now, her dad was Robert Maxwell, who was a publisher who died mysteriously. He was an English publisher. You say at some point in their lives, Robert Maxwell, Donald Trump, and Jeffrey Epstein all had ties to foreign intelligence agencies, arms dealers, and sex trade.
It's a nice group of people.
So tell us a little bit more about that.
Right. I interviewed an Israeli agent, and who worked with Robert Maxwell, and Maxwell was a fascinating character. There have been like 10 or 15 biographies of him. He died mysteriously, as you say, in 1991, having either jumped or been pushed off the yacht, his yacht, which is named the Lady Glenn, after his daughter, and he drowned in 1991. Now, he had very, very close relationships with both the KGB and with Israeli intelligence. And those are very, very well documented. And what's interesting is you see this group of people together again and again. Trump and Maxwell are out in public together at various parties. One thing I got that had not been reported or not been widely reported before was that the Israeli agent I talked to said he saw Jeffrey Epstein in the late 80s in London in the office of Robert Maxwell with Ehud Barak, who later became prime minister of Israel, but at the time was defense minister. And that's very, very interesting to me and sets off a lot of alarm bells. And you see links later on between Jeffrey Epstein and Israeli intelligence, and also with Russian intelligence in recent years. And this happens in various ways. One is, I already mentioned how those DVDs of sexual activities may or may not be in the possession as powerful compromise. But in addition, if you look at people who work for Jeffrey Epstein, one of his publicists and another woman, Ilana Pozadaeva, were working with him for long times, and they started cultivating people in the tech sector. This was not so much about sexual compromise, I believe, as infiltrating Silicon Valley and some of the most powerful people in technology. Bill Gates went to Epstein several times. Elon Musk, many, many others, people at Harvard and MIT. They were dealing in a very heady world, and there are 17,000 Russian nationals who are working in Silicon Valley. A portion of them, even a small portion, I'm told, have ties to Russian intelligence. And if you look recently, I mean, well, for years, Putin has been saying that artificial intelligence is the wave of the future. And for him, it is as important as the nuclear bomb was for Joseph Stalin. So there's a lot at stake here. And recently, it's been reported, of course, that Russia has hacked most of the United States government. And we haven't gotten to the bottom of this, but it appears to be a massive hacking that is still ongoing and can be a real threat to our national security.
So are you suggesting that industrialists or people from Silicon Valley who were higher up might have been at some of these Epstein sex parties, had videos taken of them, and then Epstein might have used the videos to force them to turn over secrets about their high-tech industries? Is that where you're getting it?
Well, I don't have specific allegations about that, but one woman, for example, Lana Pozadaeva, gave money that had been given to her, and she gave it to, I forget whether it's Harvard or MIT, but and they started centers in which Epstein was the prominent figure. And this was after 2005 when he was first arrested, and he was trying to rehabilitate his reputation. And he was doing it by giving money to these various centers on technology and so forth. And a lot of people at Harvard and so forth were taking this money. And if you look at Epstein's resume, it can seem very, very distinguished. But, I mean, you know, at the time he'd already been, he was clearly a child molester. Mm-hmm. He was clearly a pedophile. And he got this, I mean, call it a slap on the wrist is no exaggeration. He got 13 months. I believe in prison. It wasn't really in prison because he was allowed to go free like 12 hours a day.
And go to work. That was a subject of a Miami Herald series. Yeah,
absolutely. The Miami Herald did a wonderful, wonderful job on that.
All right. So just the bottom line on this is circling back to where we started. Donald Trump, you say, was most likely a Russian asset. Did Donald Trump know he was a Russian asset? Or tell me about his level of knowledge about what he thought the Russians were doing with him.
Well, this is one of those questions that can drive you crazy, because if you try to get into Donald Trump's mind, it's a hard place to go. And I can't, I'm not sure I can give definitive answers except to say this, and that is Donald Trump has a history. You know, there's a legal concept called willful ignorance or deliberate blindness. And Trump has a history of doing that to the max. And it's certainly true when it comes to laundering money, because what you have is a guy who you put, you know, $5 million on the table. He's not going to ask you where you got it. He's just going to take it. And he's done that again and again and again. He's also used his lawyers in ways that allows them to go operational when he is talking to them under attorney-client privilege. So if they goes to court, they can say, well, this is attorney-client privilege. We can't talk about that. And he's gotten away with an awful lot, and I think it's insane. I think he should have been prosecuted for money laundering 100 times over. I mean, it's one thing if he accidentally sold something to a Russian mobster, and that happened two or three times. But we've seen a pattern of this. It's happened. The sales of those condos to anonymous parties in all cash transactions has happened at least 1,300 times. That's not accidental. That's a pattern.
And finally, a lot of people want to know what the conversations entailed when then-President Trump spoke with the Russian president, Vladimir Putin, on the phone, and when the Soviet ambassador and the Soviet foreign minister came to the White House and met privately with President Trump, and he shooed out all the American reporters. He left behind the Russian photographer, and we still don't know what happened at that meeting inside the White House.
Absolutely, and that goes to compromat, because the Russians do know, and you remember once Trump only had a Russian translator. There's another time when there was an American translator and he reached over and tore up his notes. We also know Trump has had many, many phone calls with Putin, and most of them are saved in a secret server he put in the White House. No one has had access to that. But at the same time, if you go to Putin's end of the phone call, you can bet your bottom dollar that Vladimir Putin has those. And they are going to be deeply, deeply incriminating. We got a taste of that during the first impeachment trial when we saw the transcripts of the Zelensky phone call, the so-called perfect phone call. So you can bet there were a lot of perfect phone calls. And I noticed that Hillary Clinton tweeted just a couple of days ago. She has to wonder if Donald Trump was speaking to Putin just before the January 6th insurrection. The whole insurrection was very Putin-esque.
Well, Craig Unger, thanks a lot for coming on WMNF. Good to have you here.
Well, thank you. I really appreciate it.
Well, that was an interview I did yesterday with author Craig Unger. His book is American Kompromat, How the KGB Cultivated Donald Trump and Related Tales of Sex, Greed, Power, and Treachery. Just came out. He has written several other books, including House of Bush, House of Saud, which is a classic. I misspoke in that last question where I was asking about the secret meeting at the White House between the Soviet ambassador. I called it the Soviet ambassador. There I go again. It was actually a meeting between Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov and Russian Ambassador to the U.S. Sergei Kislyak. So they weren't Soviets. They were Russians at the time. The Soviet Union had long ago disappeared. President Trump met with them at the meeting in the White House and kicked out all of his staff. And the only people in there were the Russian photographer and the two Russian principals. So if you want to comment about anything you've heard here so far, you can call us up at this number, 813-239-9663. That's 813-239-9663. And we can talk about whatever issue in the news you want to talk about. We can also talk about this book that Craig just wrote and is has just come out. I should say that just wrapping up some of the things that he said there, and I'm just reading from a summary of the book, when the FBI raided Jeffrey Epstein's homes, they did find video recording equipment, hard disks, and evidence of kompromat, that's videos of billionaires, in the act of pedophilia, raping underage girls, committing crimes that could lead to hard time. This is according to Unger's book. Trump's name was in Jeffrey Epstein's black book with no fewer than 16 phone numbers. The Trump model management was very much part of Epstein's picture and allegedly indulged in many of the dubious practices, violating immigration laws and illegally employing young foreign girls, according to author Craig Unger. Epstein took the fifth when he was asked if he ever socialized with Trump in the presence of underage females under the age of 18. Epstein claimed that he was the one who introduced Melania to Trump. Jeffrey and Ghislaine Maxwell knew Trump's secrets, and he knew theirs. Secrets were the ultimate currency in the decadent and highly transactional world they lived in, according to the author, Unger. And after 17 years of friendship, that close friendship permanently fell apart in 2004 when Epstein told Trump that he was thinking about buying a big mansion in Palm Beach that was being sold out of bankruptcy auction. And Epstein had his heart set on the property. But Donald Trump somehow outbid his friend for the mansion. He bought the property for $41 million. And then, 4 years later, put it up for sale for $125 million and reportedly sold it for about $90 million, or just over $90 million, so making more than a 100% profit on that quick sale 4 years after buying it. So if you want to comment, our phone number is 813-239-9663. You can also email us here in the studio. The address is dj@wmnf.org. One person wanted to know the title of the book, and the title is called American Kompromat, to kompromat, the Soviet term for compromising material or blackmail material, K-O-M-P-R-O-M-A-T. So you can look that book up that way. So, and there's a lot going on out there, and we haven't talked about the major news stories yet. We heard the NPR news at the top of the hour, but we could talk about whatever's on your mind about the news. Jeffrey writes this: it's interesting hearing about Trump's involvement with Jeffrey Epstein. I've heard a lot of stories about Bill Clinton's involvement with Epstein coming from other media sources, especially from the QAnon types. I guess because of a big part of their narrative is that the Democrats are pedophiles. I just hope that one day we find out what was going on. Crime is bad, writes Jeff. Yeah, you know, the Clintons, or at least Bill Clinton, was supposedly flying on this plane that Jeffrey Epstein had to fly rich people around the world to his parties. His name comes up in the book, but not too often. And I couldn't do justice to the Clinton passages in the book, so I won't even try. But I do think that it would serve the public interest to find out where these videotapes are, and to really get to the bottom of this, to find out if Donald Trump or Jeffrey Epstein or anybody else was involved in underage sex trafficking. I think that would be really important to find out. 813-239-9663. Email address is dj@wmnf.org. Here's somebody who writes in. Their first name is Peace, and they say, I received the first vaccine today at the University Square Mall in Tampa. It was a pretty smooth process. I was in line at 8:30, and I was out at 10 a.m., and Peace writes, bring a pen. I'm not sure why you'd bring a pen, but Peace, thank you for that. 813-239-9663 is the number here at WMNF. Well, I'm going to mention a few items in the news, and we'll see where you want to take this conversation. The Surly Feminists are coming up in the next hour, so stick around for them. Always a highly opinionated show coming up in the next hour. Thanks to you if you called in during the WMNF fund drive that ended yesterday. It was a two-day drive. The goal was $73,000. We raised, I think, $68,000. So we were about $5,000 short. And we really appreciate everybody that made contributions over the last 2 days. We're still going to have to make up that $5,000. Sometimes it comes in very quickly because people go to our website, go to WMNF.org, and make that contribution quickly. And then other times it takes weeks or months to make up that shortfall. Let's take some phone calls. It looks like Bill Grace has stepped away from the phone room, so we're just going to put these folks on the air. Hi, caller. You're on MNF. What's your name and where are you calling from?
Dave from Bradenton.
Hi, Dave. What would you like to say?
I just had a comment and a question. My comment is most likely whenever people are so hard-pressed to blame somebody else for doing something, it's because they're guilty of it. So whenever I think of pedophilia and these people talking as all the Democrats, I feel that there most likely is evidence, or they are guilty of it. That's just my own opinion. I was hoping that you could comment on the executive order that was taken by Biden to defund the corporation-run prison.
Private prisons?
Yeah, the private prisons.
Yeah.
All right, thanks. Love your show.
All right, Dave. Thanks a lot. Thank you for that. Well, as I mentioned, Bill Grace has stepped away from the phone room, so If you were trying to call a minute ago, you can call back, and you might have to let the phone ring a little bit without a phone producer. Our phone number is 813-239-9663, and our email address is dj@wmnf.org. Well, the number of Americans applying for unemployment benefits fell to a historically high number last week, 847,000. That's a sign that layoffs remain high as the coronavirus pandemic continues to rage. Labor Department said this morning that last week's claims were down by 67,000 from 914,000 the week before, the virus hit the U.S. hard last March. Weekly applications for jobless aid had never topped 700,000. So they were 914,000 2 weeks ago and now 847,000. But the four-week moving average for claims, which smooths out weekly gyrations, rose to the highest level since September. Overall, nearly 4.8 million Americans are continuing to receive traditional state unemployment benefits. Well, stuck in the grip of a viral pandemic, the U.S. economy grew at a 4% annual rate in the final 3 months of 2020 and shrank last year by the largest amount in 74 years. For 2020 as a whole, a year when the coronavirus inflicted the worst economic freeze since the end of World War II, the economy contracted 3.5% and clouded the outlook for next year. Economic damage followed the eruption of the pandemic 10 months ago and the deep recession it triggered, with tens of millions of Americans left jobless. So if you want to talk about the economy, we are certainly open to talking about that. Our phone number, 813-239-9663. Our email address is dj@wmnf.org. Let me see if I can read some of these emails that have come in. Looks like more people are interested in emailing in. Kevin writes, did your emailer have an appointment to go in to get the vaccine at the University Square Mall? I think everybody has to have an appointment, at least right now. And they are screening people to make sure that either you're over 65 or you're a healthcare worker. That's my understanding. Now, if you've got up-to-date information, you can always call us up, 813-239-9663. The reason why you need a pen, somebody writes, is you must fill out a form while waiting, even though it's a duplicate of the form that you've already filled out during registration. So that's why you bring a pen when you're getting vaccinated. 813-239-9663. Rock writes, thanks for the show. Is it possible to get Malcolm Nance on the show? Malcolm Nance, the security expert. I haven't even tried to get him. He hasn't been offered to me, and I haven't tried to get him. Maybe we could. Let's go to Wayne in Lakeland. Wayne, thank you for calling, and what would you like to say?
Hey, Rob. Jeffrey Epstein, I always thought that he was eliminated. And just hearing from that author today kind of cements what I thought. There are a lot of powerful people in there, and he needed to be, you know, quieted. And also, I have concerns for the author. You know, Gary Webb did a thing on the CIA, and, you know, he came up missing.
Yeah, he died.
Right.
Well, I do wonder, everybody wonders about Jeffrey Epstein's death. You know, where are the videotapes of what happened in that cell that night? Why were so many security staff in that prison missing that night? This is one of the most important people that the feds have had in custody. Yeah, a lot of questions raised. I would think, you know, apparently the Republicans are very interested in Epstein because they think that it'll open the door to pedophilia by Bill Clinton. So if that were true, why wasn't there some sort of thorough investigation and report by the Trump administration? Happened under their watch. They should have issued some sort of report to say, here's the videotapes, here's what happened, here's our best estimate as to how Epstein was able to kill himself in a high security prison situation. But they didn't do any sort of major investigation that they released to the public. And I always thought that was odd. You know, if they do think that Epstein was going to help them get Clinton, why not be really thorough about Epstein's death? And they were not thorough about it. But I don't know. I'm not saying that I think Epstein was killed, I do understand why a lot of people have questions, and I think those questions need to be answered. Maybe the Biden administration will try to get to the bottom of it.
Yes, and every day we're hearing stuff. I mean, we're going to be shocked what came out of this administration.
Yeah, well, let's hope that there's much more openness in the